My name is Scott Hasserud, and this morning we're going to be looking at the wilderness experiences of Jesus. How many of you were not with us yesterday? Okay. Most of you were. For Bible study. Let me just give a brief introduction then to the process that we use. As I mentioned yesterday, there are many very important ways to approach the study of our scriptures. And what we're going to be doing here this morning, which is a very subjective method of studying our scriptures, really depends a lot on the hard work that has been done by other methods of Bible study. And but I have found over the years that I've been struggling with this method that it's a helpful way for us to gain insight from the scriptures and from each other as the scriptures intersect us and as we interface with them. It's based on the assumption that we all carry around within us tremendous insights, more insights than we have given ourselves permission to believe that we carry with us. And so the question is not so much adding more insight, but getting out the insight that we already have. Elizabeth Browning says, "Earth's crammed with heaven." Magnificent image. "Earth's crammed with heaven, and every living thing afire with God." And it seems to me if we really can go with that notion, then we can trust one another and trust each other's insight. Now the roles therefore are somewhat reversed. Traditionally the student asks the question and the teacher answers. So I'm going to be the student and you're going to be the teacher. I'm going to ask the questions and you're going to answer them. That's the way this works. And my job is to be the kind of Socratic midwife to help find the questions that are helpful to us as we come face to face with these texts. So, don't be afraid to say whatever comes to your mind. There are no right or wrong answers. There are only your responses to the questions. And one of the rules that we have is that we don't debate each other's answers, but we also give each other permission to steal whatever we say and discard whatever we don't need or is not meaningful to us. So if somebody says something that's meaningful to you, you can steal it and have it, and they're glad that you can take it with you. And you can even say it sometime when they're not around as though it was your own. That's okay. If you write it in a book and publish it, I guess you should give them credit. But okay. If you're a type of person that's hesitant to speak, push yourself. Even if it sounds foolish, we'll all be fools together, okay? So don't worry about whether your answer is not very wise or profound or... I may ask you to say your thought in a different way or to expand upon it or be more specific as I try to listen to and understand what your contribution is. So let's be courageous. We'd like to move into this morning into Jesus' wilderness experience. Now yesterday we talked a good deal about the kingdom. We talked about the narrow gate and the wide way and the kingdom of God, and one of the vigorous discussions we had was where is the kingdom of God? And we talked about the kingdom of God being within. We talked about the kingdom of God being in the midst of. And I know it provoked me to think a lot about those things last evening. And one of my, just to add a thought to that, Are you all familiar with the Gospel according to Thomas? It's a Coptic text that was discovered in Egypt. And it, I enjoy reading it for my own reflection. Anyway, Jesus is purported to have said these words there, and I offer them to you for your own reflection. If those who lead you say to you, "See, the kingdom is in heaven," then the birds of the heaven will precede you. If they say to you, "It is in the sea," then the fish will precede you. But the kingdom is within you, and it is without you. If you will know yourselves, then you will be known, and you will know that you are the sons of the living Father. But if you do not know yourselves, then you are in poverty, and you are poverty. Isn't that a marvelous statement? So you can add that to your thoughts from yesterday. Okay, we find the temptation narratives in three places in the Synoptic Gospels: Matthew 4:1-11, Mark 1:12-13, and Luke 4:1-13. And we're going to follow pretty much the Matthew text this morning, and I'll add a few things as we go along from the other texts. So if we could turn to Matthew 4:1-11, and if someone who has an RSV would be kind enough to read it for us, I would appreciate that. Yeah, there are some additional Bibles. Okay. Yeah.
Then Jesus was led up by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. And he fasted 40 days and 40 nights, and afterward he was hungry. And the tempter came and said to him, "If you are the Son of God, command these stones to become loaves of bread." But he answered, "It is written, 'Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God.'" Then the devil took him to the holy city and set him on the pinnacle of the temple and said to him, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, 'He will give his angels charge of you, and on their hands they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against a stone.'" Jesus said to him, "Again it is written, 'You shall not tempt the Lord your God.'" Again the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them. And he said to him, "All these I will give you, if you will fall down and worship me." Then Jesus said to him, "Begone, Satan, for it is written, 'You shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve.'"
Okay. And in verse, you can read the verse 11 too. Yeah.
Then the devil left him, and behold, angels came and ministered to him.
It's interesting that Mark adds wild beasts to the stew. So we have wild beasts and angels. Okay. Now, let's remember back to the baptism of Jesus for just a moment. Do you recall what happened to the Spirit in the baptism of Jesus? Do you remember?
Descended upon him.
Okay, it descended upon him. Didn't it? And what do you think the significance of that is for the Spirit of God? Is that what has happened to the Spirit in the baptismal experience of Jesus? Any thoughts come to mind?
It became a part of him, and the Spirit now dwells within him after baptism.
Okay. I think that that's just a significant thing to note here, isn't it? That it really is, in a way, it's kind of a change, or almost an evolutionary step for the Spirit, at least. And that is that it moves into human experience, doesn't it? Now, who leads Jesus into the wilderness? No?
Spirit.
It's a spirit.
Oh, yeah, the spirit.
That's right.
He's tempted out there.
Right. All right, the spirit leads, or as one text says, drives Jesus into the wilderness. Does the spirit create the wilderness?
No.
No? The wilderness is already in existence, isn't it? So the spirit who is now dwelling within leads or drives Jesus into the wilderness. Okay, let's put on our imagination caps here for a moment. When you hear the word wilderness, what do you think of? What do you picture in your mind?
New York City.
New York City, okay. All right, wonderful. Sure, all that cement, stone. Okay, what's a wilderness for some of the rest of you? Some parts of North Dakota. I mean, the vast plains. All right.
I think of the desert.
Okay, the desert. All right. What other experiences? What other?
I think around here. I mean, not
okay.
The village area, but I was
okay.
In the mountains.
The mountains. Okay.
It's an area where people don't usually go.
Okay. All right. All right.
Desolate area.
Desolate. Or it could be more intense. I mean, almost jungle-like, right? I mean,
and the last is the bush.
The bush, okay.
A place where you have to fall back on your own resources in order to survive.
Okay.
That's sort of the image there.
All right.
The sea is also a good one.
Okay, the sea, yeah. All right, right, you're alone. Survival is an issue there for you, right? In a way in which it's not in a non-wilderness place. Right? Yeah. Okay, let's internalize that symbol for a moment. How would you describe in your own life or in others or wilderness experiences inwardly in relationship with others in terms of events of your life, and let's be as specific and as concrete as we would care to with the group. What would be an example of a wilderness experience that you've had or you've observed in others? Or
death of a loved one.
Okay, the death of a loved one is certainly a wilderness experience. Yeah.
Sometimes I think even a change of job can be sort of a wilderness experience, at least
for me.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so, very much. That passage from one place to another in terms of vocation or a career choice, change, and so forth. All right. Okay, what else could be a wilderness experience?
Having some kind of personal problems and feeling there's nobody you can turn to.
Okay. All right. Very much so, yeah.
Illness, severe
illness. Illness, okay. Right. Okay. Any other things come to mind?
Divorce.
Divorce, certainly. This is a very much a wilderness experience. Okay, now, it says in our text that the Spirit led or drove Jesus into the wilderness. And as we've already said, the Spirit didn't create the wilderness. It was already there. It was a given, right? But what is the significance of the Spirit leading or driving as opposed to Jesus stumbling upon the wilderness? Can you feel into that? What would be the difference between being led or driven as opposed to just...
It wasn't by accident.
It's not by accident, right? Yeah. Okay.
I suppose like Job, the devil effect, this is an assumption.
It's all right.
That the devil had to have permission from God before the temptation.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The devil had God's permission before.
All right. In terms of Job, yeah, there's that discussion that goes on, and they make some wagers and so forth. Right?
Certainly, the strength of character would come out much more in heaven than
drifting.
Okay.
And you're just going of your own volition.
Okay. All right.
And it seems to me if the Spirit drove him or led him, there was a purpose in it.
Okay. All right. Okay.
And it was the Father's will, I would think, wouldn't it?
Okay.
Wouldn't that be the way he perceived it?
Okay. Somehow God is behind this, or up to it, or involved in it, or something. All right. Okay.
Well, if the wilderness is a part of life that we all have to contend with, and I think this, for me anyway, is an assurance that it too is of God, and that He is present in it.
Okay. It doesn't say whether God created it or not, but certainly God is involved in driving Jesus into it, right? So there's an intentionality there, a choice there, a relationship to the wilderness that would be different than if he just stumbled on it or. So there's, it maybe says something to us. Well, let's ask that question. I don't have that down here, but I always think of questions as we go on. You know, for feeling into that for Jesus, well, how might that be helpful to us as we approach our wilderness experiences? In other words, there possibly is different ways to approach a wilderness experience, right?
Sometimes these wilderness experiences are rather thrust upon us, so we
okay.
have no idea they're coming.
All right.
Although, you know, death is coming.
Right.
But it's way in the future.
Right.
And so you aren't preparing for that. You're just preparing for tomorrow,
right.
The next day, the next week. You're preparing for that. Some terminal illness, so all of a sudden it's there.
Right.
My thinking is he was led by the Spirit, but he also had to follow. But why did he want to follow? Why did he want to go into the wilderness? He had pretty well determined his philosophy and so forth, or was he a little bit unsure about it? Did he need 40 days to reassure himself?
Let me bracket that question and ask that one at the end of the study again. And we'll struggle with that, okay? That's because that is a very important question. Okay, well, it just feels to me like there's an intentionality that a wilderness, right? Whether the, I guess one could say, couldn't you, that some, as you said so aptly, often these wilderness experiences they come up unexpectedly, but perhaps. We have the choice of whether we face them intentionally or whether we try to avoid them. And we're impressed by the intentionality, at least at this point, there's an intentionality on the part of the Spirit, whether Jesus is led or driven kicking and screaming, or whether he goes, we don't really, you know. It could have been, yeah, yeah.
You suddenly have this
experience, yeah. Okay, now it says that in the wilderness, Jesus was tempted. What does that word mean to you? What does it mean to be tempted?
It has to do something you normally wouldn't do, maybe.
All right. Okay, what does tempted mean? What does that word conjure up in your mind?
Someone that's desirable.
Okay.
I keep thinking of yesterday's discussion with the wide gate, the easy way out.
Okay. All right.
It's another choice.
Okay. All right.
Is wrongdoing always connected with tempted? To me, it seems like it's always something wrong.
Or could be wrong if we did it, right?
Well, there are a couple of different ways that temptation is used. Someone is tempted to have another milkshake.
Okay.
Well, whether or not that's right or wrong might depend on the person, but having a milkshake, there's nothing wrong with that. But I think of it in terms of It's an invitation to something that's in the area of evil or wicked.
Okay. All right. Okay.
I tend to think I was something that can prevent me from growing.
Okay.
Something that isn't in your best interest.
But it seems to me, though, that if you're tempted, it's something that that you really would sort of like to do in a way. And yet you know that it's not probably the right thing for you or for somebody else.
Also, I think
otherwise it wouldn't be a temptation.
Okay, all right.
Also, there has to be an element of opportunity there too.
All right.
To be tempted, you must be able to reach out and grasp it also.
All right.
If it's something out of your grasp, then you might not be tempted at all.
All right.
It's a moment of decision.
Okay. Yes. Certainly a moment of decision, isn't it? Well, you're going to go this way, you're going to go that way. Maybe there's more than two alternatives. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Some wonderful images there. That are helpful. Now we're gonna. I want to pass over the devil or Satan until the end, but we'll come back to that figure. Now it also says that Jesus fasted. Have any of you fasted? Is that an experience any of you have had?
Well, I
went to
the
event.
Yeah.
Yeah, 12 hours.
Okay.
Of
your own willing?
Yeah. Okay. Well, tell me, from what you do know about fasting, or you've heard, you know, what happens when you fast, supposedly?
Well, I just did it for one day.
Okay.
And by the evening, I just had quite a headache.
Yeah. Yeah, that's my experience too. Lots of pain.
Physical weakness.
Okay.
Lightheaded.
What?
I got lightheaded.
You get real lightheaded. All right.
I get dehydrated.
Dehydrated. All right.
I hate to throw a bomb in the works, but I tried it for 24 hours. And I felt
okay. Yeah.
Okay. 50 hours.
Uh-huh.
Well, of course, I drank water, but I mean.
Yeah.
No, if that's fasting or not.
Yeah. What was it like?
Well, I think mostly it was that I missed the habit of eating.
Okay.
Because I was thinking about Gregory, was his name? Guy that was fasting all the time. Dick Gregory goes for long, long times. I figured I could do it for 48 hours without dying. Like that was all right.
Yeah. Well, what did you learn, even in our brief sojourns into that? What did you learn from that experience?
I probably wouldn't do it again.
All right. Okay.
Well, that you can get along with this food in
you. Okay. All right. All right. What else did you learn?
That it can alter our normal characteristics of thinking.
All right.
It increases your desire.
Okay.
Whatever you're skipping out.
All right.
Three milkshakes,
right. Going from two to three.
One thing you learned quick, I think, is that you can do with a lot less.
All right.
And it kind of clears your mind.
All right. I'm told by people who fast, you know, for lengthy periods of time, it really does. And by that, they drink water and stuff, juices and so forth, but don't eat, that they do get a clarity. They tell me that somehow a lot of the poisons in their system, you know, get washed out and so forth. Yeah. Once they get beyond the initial pain and agony of it all. Certainly we learned, I know when I've tried it, I learned how dependent I am. And on, you know, eating, and I certainly learned, my body certainly acquaints me with itself in ways it doesn't when I'm, you know, I think I can go through days and not be aware I have a body. I don't think about it much. And certainly fasting, kind of like, you know, when you do break a limb, or if you do live with pain, lots of people live with pain, are aware of their bodies in a way in which we are. Apparently, what would it mean to fast? Let's look at it symbolically now. What would it mean for us to fast as we face these wilderness experiences in our life? If we would look at it symbolically rather than literally, what would it mean to fast? What could it mean to fast? Okay, let's say this in some other ways. What would it mean to fast? What could it mean possibly to fast as we face wilderness experiences?
I don't think it would mean anything unless you also pray.
Okay.
You have to meditate, preparatory or something.
It's a preparatory step.
Temporary reflection on your problems.
Okay. Certainly a reflection on what we think we're dependent upon. Certainly awareness of ourselves, and perhaps in some total ways, and so forth. Okay, well, you can mull that one over. What it says that Jesus did that for 40 days. Why 40 days, do you think?
Long time. 40 days is kind of a symbolic number.
Right. Okay. 40 is used a lot in the scriptures, right? What? Have any idea what it's used for?
Rain 40 days.
40 nights, right. Right. Think of other 40.
Jesus appeared in the resurrection form of 40. Went up to heaven for 40 days.
All right.
I have to tell you about my cousin's head. She had been my gal all my life. And when I moved to Alaska, she told my daughter, when I moved, she said, I cried for 40 days and 40 nights, and then I threw up.
Oh. And then it was all over. Literally. Okay, right. 40 years in the wilderness. Okay. What?
It's used a lot.
Yeah, so 40 is used a lot, and somehow it's a 4, of course, is a complete number, right? It's a whole. 4 is a whole. Mandalas always have 4 points. I mean, there's 4 seasons and 4 points to the compass. And so anyway, I suppose, you know, that there's something about fasting and preparing in a complete way for this wilderness experience.
Do you think it's symbolic rather than actual, the 40 days?
Well, I would guess that, you know, who knows? I the answer is I don't know. That's the real answer. But a lot of numbers like this in our scripture are probably symbolic. Like the 12 tribes of Israel with 12,000 people and so on and so forth. I mean, you know, most of those numbers tend to be, as the accounts are written, that was an important number. And so...
To me, it sort of made an emphasis for an extremely long time.
Yeah.
We think in periods of time, like a month.
Yeah.
Well, here it was 10 right. days.
Right. Yeah.
Beyond the month. So
right.
To me, it emphasized time.
Right. It also reminds me that these wilderness experiences don't get over in a day, or a week. But often go on for a long time, and that there may be a certain time that's necessary for its completion, and we have a tendency probably to try to short circuit the time get it over with faster, right? Rather than...
That's the American way.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So it really raises the question for us, what does it mean to allow the experience to be there as long as it needs to be there? Then to go on from it. Okay, let's get on to the temptations. What is the first temptation? Would somebody read that for us?
When the devil took him to the holy city and set him on the pinnacle of the temple and said to him, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down.
That's the second one. Read the first one for us.
If you are the Son of God, command these stones to become loaves of bread.
Okay.
And he answered, it is written, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from God.
Okay. Okay, what is Jesus being tempted with in this first temptation?
Food.
Okay. Yeah. Food? What else is...
Take care of himself first.
Okay, take care of himself first.
Well, hunger would be his weak moment.
Okay. He's been fasting, right?
Being tempted to show his power, too.
Being tempted to show his power, right? To show off for the tempter. Okay. All right. Okay. Anything else we could say? What is he being tempted with? Okay, how do you experience that temptation? We have to really kind of stretch ourselves a little bit. How do you experience that sensation?
Well, there's the element of pride.
Okay.
And I'm always fighting pride. I remember Pastor Price gave two sermons on pride, and I drove 60 miles to hear him the second time, because he said that is the greatest temptation, pride.
What is pride? What does that mean? What is pride?
Self first.
Don't think about what he said. Think. What do you think it means? What do you think pride means?
I think it's elevation of self.
Elevation of. You mean thinking more highly of yourself than you ought to, or is that what you mean? Is that what pride is?
Well, I guess I'm thinking, the way I'm thinking, it's pretty close to selfishness.
All right.
Me first.
Taking credit for the things we do when actually we should be giving God some credit.
Okay. So you're saying taking more credit than we should take.
Look at me, what I've done. Forgetting that if God and the Spirit wasn't working within you, you probably could not have done it.
Okay, so it's not acknowledging your dependence upon others or upon God. Mm. You did it yourself,
yeah.
All by yourself, without any help from anyone else. Okay. All right. How else is this temptation? Is this a temptation that you experience?
Well, I think it speaks in terms of hungry for food, but I think we can think in terms of hungry for anything.
Okay.
That might be desirable for us.
Word command significant there?
All right. What comes to your mind?
Well, the authority.
All right.
Figure. Anytime you command.
All right.
You'd
like to be able to command that your needs be met instantaneously. The pill approach.
Sort of back to the infancy phase.
too, you know.
Okay.
Voice your need, and you get, if you're a loved child, you get an immediate...
Instant gratification.
Gratification.
Okay. All right. Okay. Yeah, I was thinking about this morning too, and I think sometimes I have a tendency to want somebody to sort of miraculously bail me out and not have to take responsibility for the situation, but and work it through and live through it that was one association that I had with this particular temptation. Certainly Jesus is it's being suggested that he use his power to satisfy his need. Okay, and in response to that, Jesus says what? Someone read that for us.
Man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God.
Okay. What in the world did he mean by that?
The life that you're eating.
Okay. All right.
That's an awfully difficult thing to say after 40 days.
All right. Okay, he's not saying that eating is not important, right? Sometimes this statement has been used earlier this morning. Sergio, our Brazilian chap who's here, said that, you know, sometimes this text is used in his country by Pentecostals to suggest that people ought not to worry about their economic situation, so it can become an abdication of that. But it doesn't say that. It doesn't say that one shouldn't have bread. It just says that one shouldn't live by bread alone, right? Okay. And what is Jesus suggesting that one should live by in addition to bread?
I suppose one might tend to think of the catechism on the petition where Jesus Luther. Defines bread as everything that's needed for life,
okay.
Not just physical food.
Right.
I think of it from the standpoint that God takes care of our total needs,
okay.
So that the diet that He supplies us is inclusive of physical, spiritual, mental, and emotional.
Okay. Okay. Very good. All right. Okay. What would it mean for you not to live by bread alone? What do you need?
Bread symbolizes, in this case, the immediate gratification. Uh-huh. We're sometimes tended to live day to day by the immediate gratification,
okay.
Rather than the thought out. Deeper
thing. All right.
Bread symbolizes for me the physical, but there's much more to life than the physical.
Okay.
There's the emotional side,
right.
The spiritual side of living. And certainly just the physical need doesn't, I can't imagine just being supplied with just physical needs.
If he was like the rich man, you know, and gathered all this stuff in his barn, maybe you just should not live by bread alone, just not only thinking about the material things, but something besides the material things.
All right.
Well, I've been eating a lot of meals alone lately, and there isn't nearly as much fun and well, all those good associations that you have from sitting down to a table full of food with people you love around you. So your companions, you know, the relationship part.
You're not actually as satisfied.
Okay.
Yes.
I've never seen that in that text before, but that's interesting. Man should not live by bread alone. That's interesting, isn't it?
That's like a,
why not?
A little taught in church one day, question his dad about at Christmas time, what does it mean, take not thy presence from me?
Yeah. So it's a recognition that we need to live in relation to others, whether we have a full-time partner or not. You know, we need to create those relationships.
And you think that's what it means there?
Well, I'd never seen that before, but why not? Huh? Who knows? If that's what it provokes in us at the moment.
The man shall not live only by bread.
Okay.
Yeah, I know, but that's another. Yeah. That alone.
That's an interesting twist that I think is true, whether it means that or not.
Yeah, somebody in the other room.
Yeah.
Well, and we share the loaf in communion.
Sure. Sure.
Then you get right back to what this bread means.
Yeah.
Definitions.
Yeah. But by every word. Okay. Okay, so it's Jesus is rejecting here this miracle worker power role in favor of a different stance, right? Which could include a more relational perspective on how one is to live. Okay, let's go on to the second. Lest we linger too long on each of these. Second temptation. Someone read for us the second one.
Then the devil took him to the holy city and set him on the pinnacle of the temple and said to him, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will give his angels charge of you, and on their hands they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against a stone.
Okay, what is he being tempted with here?
Prove yourself.
All right. What else? How else would you say it?
To do something foolish.
Okay.
Yeah.
See if God will bail you out. Mm-hmm. Show his faith. All right.
Well, if he did that, they would know right away that he was the Messiah.
Okay. Psalm 91?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Okay. It's a quotation from Psalm. Yeah. Okay. What is he being tempted?
Yeah. I can pre-associate here a little bit.
Okay, good. That's what we want to do.
Because we talked about dreams yesterday.
Yeah.
I went through a period in my life where I had a recurring dream of being able to levitate.
Okay.
And it was wonderful because my friends could see me, and I had this power and this. I would wake up with this feeling of self-importance and power.
Okay.
And so that's what I relate mostly to this passage.
Right. Okay. Good. Good. Okay. Well, that's a good bridge into it. How are we tempted like this? That would certainly be one way.
It's proof of importance. Being born up by angels would certainly.
Okay.
Keep your people of importance.
All right. On our side and wants you to send in $50 to you're watching the television, you know. And so there's an awful lot of that inflation. We get puffed up psychologically we call it inflation. And our own self-importance gets out of hand. And that's often when people begin doing very destructive things to other people because they think that you know, God is on their side totally, and everything they do and anything they say is, you know, like what? That, yeah, right. Yeah, and we see a lot of those. Well, I call them religious hucksters on television. And okay, now what's Jesus' response to that? What in the world did he mean by that?
Don't tempt God to...
Okay. Don't tempt God to poof. Right. That's a neat phrase.
Not great.
No, it's good. I like it. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. And they're really, that temptation is really a part of our experience, isn't it? We want God to poof. We want God to what? Do things the way we want them done. That will increase our stature. Right. Okay. Finally, the third temptation. Someone read it for us.
Again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them. And he said to him, "All these I will give you if you will fall down and worship me."
Okay, what is he offering Jesus?
What he already owns.
Okay, he's offering him the kingdoms of the world, right? Did the tempter have that really to offer?
That's what I was trying
to say. So like selling
food. But Jesus had this power. He could wipe out the Roman Empire. He could establish his own empire.
Okay.
Well, he's
straight
a liar,
up.
So whether we could or not.
What?
If he is a liar, so whether he owns it or not, okay, or has the power or not, he could still say it.
But could he own part of it? I mean, certainly, the earth is the Lord's, but
okay,
it's only if we give it to him.
Okay. Let's suppose that Jesus had said, "Okay, I'll take it." Yeah. I always struggle with figuring out how to ask this, but what's really going on here? What is the tempter really offering?
I think it's a power struggle.
Okay. Right.
He's trying to trick him.
Okay.
You know, he thinks, the devil thinks he's got Jesus at a weak point here.
Okay.
And I think that's what temptation is, really, to get us to make the other choice. We don't have the strength to put the temptation aside. So
yeah,
it's possible that the devil thought Jesus might think that.
Okay. He might bite. Huh?
He might bite, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
It's the third one, he's tired, you know. Yeah.
He's getting hungrier as the days are going along here. So he's really offering him an illusion, right? to see if he'll bite. How do we experience that? What would be an example of being offered in a, you know, all the world?
Media preaching where if you believe in God, everything will go wonderful.
Okay.
The world doesn't say about that.
So no acknowledgement of the dark side, the reality of the dark side. No inclusion of the dark side. Okay.
How about buying a laundry ticket?
Okay. Or maybe the temptation is to depend upon that kind of methodology to bail one out. You know, I mean, people, that's part of their plan. They're going to win the lottery, see? Which I think is one of the real problems with lotteries is we have enough problem in our country with somebody else, something else is going to bail me out. We have, you know, very traditional messianic kinds of expectations rattling around within us that take secular forms. I think the lottery being one of them. speaking from a psychological perspective. Okay. What other kinds of illusions are sometimes
prodigal son
tempting?
Illusion. The,
okay. The grass is going to be greener someplace else. So it was difficult, you know. He hadn't accepted the notion that the only way out is through. And, okay.
Could it possibly be sometimes if you meet someone and if you're in the right frame of mind, you think that that person is going to be everything for you?
That happens when we fall in love. That's a marvelous expression, because that's what happens. We fall in love. Right, they're going to save us. Right, everything is going to be come up roses. What? Solve all our problems. What we don't know is that that's where the problems all begin.
They're falling in love, but that's what
that's right. It's a two-way street.
Hopefully.
Yeah. Well, you see, we'd never get together if that didn't happen. So it's not altogether bad. But
yeah, I was just going to say, that's not a pretty bad illusion.
Yeah.
Right. So,
nice bubble. Yeah.
But maybe more so, there's a lot of that that goes on in religious cultism, where a particular group or a particular guru is going to solve all of our problems, right, for us. Okay, and what is Jesus' response to that one?
You shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve.
Okay. What does that mean, do you think, for us?
Don't expect anything in life to completely satisfy you except that relationship.
Also, you should serve just one Lord, not two or three. Yeah.
Good.
Or see me in all those illusions.
Yeah.
See me.
Okay. I can't help but think of this in terms of Sergio's talk last night and the pattern that we in the United States have gotten into. In a way, we've really, as a nation, bought into this third temptation. Showing him all the kingdoms of the world and the glory of them. All these I will give you. We've sort of assumed nationally, I think, that we have a right under God, even. We've gone so far as to think that.
Yeah.
To all of these third world resources, okay, to use them for our own.
We used to have a doctrine about that. We call it, manifest destiny, didn't we? We had the right to. We were the true inheritors of the land, and we had the right to push everyone else off of it, and so forth. Right. That's been very much a part of our heritage as Western Europeans as we moved to this country, and so forth.
Now,
this,
I may be out of it, but
that's all right around here.
It really doesn't say much about what you're going to get out of it, though. Is that? Because it says, worshiping God. Okay. Yeah, you do get stuff out of it, but that, the attention is on God and not on you. And him only shall you serve,
okay,
but not in him only shall you get gratification.
Okay.
So.
It certainly tells us where we need to keep focused, doesn't it, as we move along through these wilderness experiences. Otherwise, we can easily get deluded. Looking back at Jesus for just a moment, what is going on through all of this with Jesus? What is he really being offered? Anybody have some thoughts about that? What is he really being offered here? And what is he turning down?
Life. I mean, he's choosing life on earth.
Okay. All right.
As opposed to
some kind of what?
Magic realm.
Magic realm. All right. Okay. What else would you say? What is he turning down here?
This is the same thing that you said. He's turning down the temptation to show his heavenly power.
Okay. All right. Okay.
I think that throughout Jesus is the servant.
All right.
Mm-hmm. He's the servant, not okay. the high echelon.
Okay.
And I think that he's trying to show that this is the important part.
Okay. He's turning down the opportunity to be God.
Okay.
You know, to be in authority, so to speak.
Okay.
Self-aggrandizement.
He's turning down self-aggrandizement, right? Okay.
He's turning down every chance to go through the wide gate and he's choosing
okay.
to
make it anyway. Okay. Yeah, good image. He really is turning down, isn't he, all those traditional expectations that the Hebrew community had for what the Messiah would be like, right? This is what they expected the Messiah to do, was to be able to do these kinds of things, right? And so, what would you say, so what happens to him in this experience in the wilderness? How does he come out of this experience? You know, assuming that Jesus, this is an experience of integrity for Jesus. I mean, he's not just pretending or play acting, but, you know, these temptations are really temptations. It's not just going through some kind of motion. But that his own humanity, you know, as Christians we say Jesus was fully human and fully divine, not one quarter and three quarters or one half and one half, but both, right? So we have to believe that these temptations were real temptations. They weren't just a ritual or make-believe or something. So what happens to Jesus in this experience, would you say?
Strengthened.
Okay, strengthened.
Tired. I think that
tired.
He is God, but he has to continue to humble himself.
Right. Okay.
All of his walk through life, culminating in the crucifixion.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
Maybe it enabled him to meet some of the other, because he had to go through a great number of crises.
Right.
And it enabled him to meet those, so
okay.
a little bit more.
All right. Okay. All right.
Probably better prepared him to Gethsemane, too.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
In a way, it was with the sort of the final stamp on him as both human and divine.
Okay.
Because what human could have withstood the temptations and yet you wouldn't expect God, on the other hand, to have to face these temptations.
Okay.
Even on the cross, he got the same temptation. Mm-hmm. You are the Son of God.
Right. Mm-hmm. Throw yourself down. Get out. Yeah. Right. So it really seems to me that through this experience, his vocation is clarified. That he comes away with a clarity about what he's called to do, or that which was in him is affirmed in some way. that he comes away different. That he's gotten to a new place through this. He's been strengthened, prepared him for Gethsemane. The crisis has prepared him to meet other crises down the road, and that there's a clarity about his role now, namely that it's going to be a servant role, and that he's not going to accept any of the messianic hopes. what fascinates me is that these messianic hopes are still very much alive today. At least they are in my part of the world, amongst the Christian community. In other words, they expect Jesus to come again, and pretty much in terms of the temptation, I mean, that's the way Jesus is pictured in coming. And I don't know if that's true in your part of the country, but that's very much true in the Southwest and in Southern California, where I was a parish pastor. Well, Jesus will come again, and he will do miraculous, powerful. He will set himself up pretty much like in these images that Jesus has rejected here. And particularly folks that talk a lot about the rapture. Do you have talk about that? And image Jesus' second coming in that way. Okay, so anyway, out of this experience, Jesus' vocation, Jesus, how he's going to proceed with his life is clarified. How do wilderness experiences help us? If you can look back upon a wilderness experience, you know, and the pain and the anguish and the suffering that often accompanies it, how potentially, now I'm not saying that all wilderness experiences help us, because I think some devastate us, and maybe it has a lot to do with how we deal with them while we're in it, but how do you see that they could potentially be of help to us personally? Or maybe you could share an experience, if you're willing, of how it might, how it could have helped you, or did help you.
I don't know if it helps you. I think this too does pass. You know, it becomes something that, I don't know that it helps, but it's something you do not particularly talk to, but it goes over. And it's,
okay. So the knowledge that it will pass
is a help.
That's a help, isn't it? Okay. Because when you're in the midst of it, you wonder if it's ever going to pass. Okay.
I think you often become, you are stronger as a result of it, and your priorities shift your mountains.
So it helps, it can help clarify your priorities in life, right? Okay, I think that, in other words, if the wilderness experience is dealt with at all, it can really help you help your priorities. Yeah.
A lot of faith experiences have its roots in
okay.
those kind of wilderness
All right.
Experiences too. So there's a lot of new birth there.
Okay. It helps you get connected to the transcendent, or that which is beyond you, or to God, in a way in which perhaps had you not had a wilderness experience.
And I like that idea of the time, because with the pill and all that stuff that we want now,
yeah.
I think the wilderness experience too, for me, it has taught me that the time is important, that I have to allow that to work through in its time, not in my time.
Okay.
So I've learned that it will pass, and not to concern to allow it to happen.
Okay.
It's hard to do. I think that's a real temptation.
Yeah.
To want it to pass now.
Yeah. It's also a temptation for some people, I think, to stay in it too long, and not put it into the past when its time is up. So there's maybe a, in other words, sometimes we hang on to those. We get. What did you say yesterday? You said something about pity pot or no?
Pity party.
Pity party, right? We don't recognize that the party's over and we need to go home, you know. All right.
One of the things that bothers me is the barrage of different opinions about all of this that exists in the world today. Now, when my daughter was about 5 or 6 years old, like, they sang Jesus Loves Me, This I Know, and her faith was just so strong. And I remember my mother's faith was just this strong. Right. But I don't think she was subject to, I mean, she came from an environment where it was only Lutheran tradition, and there was not even, I think in the case of my mother, not even the Pentecostals in Sweden, for instance, weren't even influencing her life, or the extreme right was influencing her life. Right. And today you have, you begin to wonder, well, about, I mean, we are taught that in baptism we are born again, but you get people that are born again Christians who say, well, you're not born again, you know. And then you you get the barrage of the just the atheist nations in the world. And then as we become studying, as we study, for instance, the comparative religions, which I've not done a lot of, but we've even talked about this before, about them. And the Muslims and Muslims and Buddhists and all those, you know, it takes an awful lot of faith to sit down there and discard all this in the wilderness.
To sort it out, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that I'm capable of sorting it out entirely.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure I am either. I'm not sure that anyone is entirely. I think wilderness experiences do help us clarify what is important to us, and what we're going to go with, you might say. And I think we can do that and feel comfortable with that, at the same time recognizing there's a lot of folk out there who don't necessarily see things exactly the way we do. I think one of the things you raise is very interesting, because it is a time, you could say one of the minus sides of our time is all this confusion. Perhaps a plus sign is the fact that it forces us to take responsibility for where we're going to stand, perhaps in a way in which perhaps people who are raised in a very homogeneous culture where one's religion, one's values, one's culture, one's traditions are pretty self-contained, and one is not bombarded by lots of different, you know, perspectives. I think the plus side for us is that it does force us to look at and take responsibility for, you know, who we are and what we're going to be. And I think Jesus is perhaps more of a help than we've ever imagined, if we're willing to let his life and his teachings be guideposts for our own development as we work through these various things. Would you say this was a positive experience or a negative experience for Jesus then? Depends on what you let. In other words, had he bit on the hook, it wouldn't necessarily have ended up being a positive experience, right? So is being tempted positive or negative, or what makes it positive or negative?
Your reaction to it.
Your reaction to it, right? Yeah. I think so. Which gets us into a profound theological question, which I don't want to touch with a 10-foot pole, but that is, does Satan serve a creative function in this...
Well, I think it's far healthier for us to regard him that way than to keep bringing his name up, as I hear so many of the, you know, more Pentecostal people doing. It seems that Satan's name is sometimes the elevated to greater heights than God is in their conversations about warnings about Satan. And
they're more concerned with Satan.
The power that Satan has is they seem to be obsessed with it.
Right. We really have two gods in evangelical piety today. We have Satan and we have God. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Sarah, and so forth. And that's interesting. I think that's very true. But perhaps where it would have been evil is, as you say, had Jesus gone off with it, or if we go off with these temptations, then perhaps that's where it becomes evil. It seems to me that being tempted is pretty much a given. Are there any of you that have never been tempted here? Shall we form a club? You know. So I don't see the reality of not, you know, and I have to, you know, another bias I have is a lot of my theology is cooked up in the streets rather than in the study, and it just seems to me the reality of life is that we all get tempted. I haven't met anybody yet that. You ought to get that class back together now and see if they answer in the same way. Well, so if in fact being tempted, or if in fact the reality of Satan is the tempter, the devil, those are the words that are used, is a given in our life's experience, then the question is raised, how are we going to respond to that? And particularly, this text raises the question of how do we respond to that in our wilderness experiences. In Elizabeth Howe's book, Jesus' Answer to God, which also will be available in the library when it comes, she says, the Spirit in Jesus was concerned that the religious experience led to facing issues. That our religious experience leads us to facing issues of conflict, involving conflict, involving choice, and even involving temptation. None of these can occur in unconsciousness. Rather, they demand consciousness, such as emerged for Jesus from the baptismal experience. And that's always been a kind of helpful statement. Now, at the end of Jesus' experience, he was ministered to by angels. And Mark says he was with the wild beasts. So if we could put the two together, why in the world wild beasts and angels, do you think? What does your imagination say about that? What? Oh, it says in Mark, all we have is that the Spirit immediately drove him out into the wilderness, and he was in the wilderness 40 days, tempted by Satan. And he was with the wild beasts, and the angels ministered to him. That's all that's included in the gospel.
The wild beasts are ministering to him?
What?
I got the impression that the wild beasts were in the wilderness.
Okay, and he was with the wild beasts, and the angels ministered to him. Okay, he was with the wild beasts, and the angels ministered to him.
Yeah,
you're right.
Good news
Good
says
the
angels.
Beasts
mentioned. That once the Spirit made him go into the desert where he stayed 40 days being tempted by Satan, wild animals were there also, but an angel came and helped him.
Okay. What do wild beasts symbolize for you?
Hunger.
All right.
Fear.
Danger.
Danger. Okay, all right. Sort of the dark creatures, or they exist in dark places or something.
Creatures of the night.
All right. I have a few of those in my nighttime dreams once. I just let me just, our time is up here. We want to go get a cup of coffee, so I'll just read to you Elizabeth House, who's a psychologist, writes, what experience for Jesus may have been behind the words about wild beasts and angels? Surely they represent a pair of opposites confronting Jesus from within and without. Wild beasts could be deep, instinctual, unconscious forces, powers, not necessarily negative, but overwhelming, dark realities that have been unleashed in the baptism experience as part of God's reality. At the same moment that he was with these wild beasts, angels were also present as potential integrative forces, as presences and powers that need to be known. Both wild beasts and angels then may be manifestations of God. And then she writes the phrase that I really wanted to read to you. Perhaps we know all too little about the healing presence of angels because we do not face the dark world of wild beasts. And the thing that jogged my mind when I read that was the fact that maybe one of the values of wilderness experiences for us is that in the context of, and you mentioned this, of the wilderness experience, we recognize the opposite, the healing power of God. In other words, in the valleys of life, somehow, we come face to face with God in a way in which we never did before, the healing power of God. And that maybe one of the problems in our society today is the tendency to want to always avoid the wildernesses, always avoid the valleys. And we really don't want to accept the notion that the only way out is through. We'd all like to do end runs around those or avoid them or escape them or anesthetize ourselves. That's the most popular way, is just to drug ourselves, you know, one way or the other, television or whatever we do to do that. And therefore not face consciously and intentionally those experiences. Well, you're a wonderful group to be with, and our hour and a half has gone by like that for me, so it's now coffee time.